Well, when I was in seminary, I had a professor, and we had chapel sermons, which means there were little worship services throughout the week, and they were on Wednesday. And there was a professor, and he was kind of infamous for this. He would come up to the pulpit, and he would say, "Well, this morning, I have 32 points that I would like to get through." And these were 20-minute chapel sermons, mind you. They were quick 32 points. I say this for no other reason than to ease some of the panic when I tell you that I have 5 points this morning. And if it helps, and if there's any professors giving extra credit, all these points start with the same letter. They taught me that at school. This morning, as we look at the covenant to David, we're going to be looking at 5 things. The plan, the problem, the promise, the person, and the place. The plan, the problem, the promise, the person, and the place. So let's start with the plan. Now, there isn't anything wrong with a plan. I want to say that right away. If you're worried that I was going to get up and say, "Don't ever plan anything, it's bad," that's not the message of today. We all have plans. We all have plans of what we should do, what our goals are, and ultimately, most of our plans point towards the same end, security, in some form or another. And that's a good thing. We want our families to be secure, our futures to be secure. We want to be financially secure, physically secure, mentally, spiritually, emotionally, socially, and we plan for it. Now, the problem with planning is that we all try to plan for a kind of security that's fairly elusive, permanent security. We don't only want to have security today, we want to have that tomorrow. And so many of us are in school, or we're working very hard, or we're working out very hard, or we're socializing very hard so that we can have security today and forever. And so I want to start a theme I'm going to be picking up on as I talk. Think about this for a second. What is your plan? What is your plan for security? How do you plan to be safe in whatever way you feel the need to be safe, not only today, but in perpetuity? You see, again, planning is not bad. Like they say, if you fail to plan, then you plan to fail. And our passage really is about David planning to get security, not only for himself, but for all of his people, which is why it's surprising and I think alarming for us when we see that God rejects David's plan for security. Now, most of us didn't read that as a plan for security. See, we read in the passage that David wants to build God a house. But let me give you a bit of a history. See, at this point in David's life, he's done a lot to secure Israel. He has fought several of Israel's enemies. He has established a place for them, united the northern and southern kingdoms. And most recently, he's brought back something called the Ark of the Covenant. Now, the Ark, this is something you learn about in the book of Exodus. The Ark is this beautiful, beautiful, I want to say relic, but that doesn't quite capture it, of God's people that signified and in fact carried God's presence and blessing. What would happen often through the battles in 1 and 2 Samuel is they would carry the Ark into battle and they would say, "Wow, we won." And the Ark had been taken away and they noticed that things weren't going well. And in fact, the Ark was such a powerful thing that when the Philistines, the enemies of God's people, had it, they were all getting sick. And then when they were carrying the Ark back to Jerusalem, somebody touched it on accident, and he died. So this is a powerful, powerful thing. And so by this point in the story, as we see, David has pushed away all the enemies. He's returned to the Ark, and now he looks at his situation. And what he sees is that he lives in a beautiful house of cedar, but God dwells in a tent. And cedar was kind of the wealthy wood. It was like a kingly wood. And so he says, "Okay, well, if I have such a beautiful house, shouldn't God?" Now, in one sense, this is very pious. This is a great thing to do. But think of what this meant. See, if the Ark carried with it such a powerful blessing, and it had been dwelling in a tent. And a tent is a, by its very nature, a mobile dwelling. Then keeping in a tent carried with it the risk that maybe the ark will leave again. And if the ark leaves, maybe God's presence and God's blessing will leave again. So if you build a permanent dwelling for God's presence and God's blessing, then you have it forever and it can't be taken away. So that's the plan. David, in both honoring God, wanting to build God a house, also wants to build a permanent place for the ark so that God's people will have God's permanent blessing and be permanently secure. And then God says no. Why? That seems like a great plan. Well, that's the plan, but let's go into the problem. See, if you look at verse 3, you see David presents this plan to Nathan, and then Nathan says, go and do all that's in your heart. And that very night, it says God came and spoke to Nathan, and starting in verse 5, this is what we see. Would you build me a house to dwell in? I have not lived in a house since the day I brought up the people of Israel from Egypt to this day, but I have been moving about in a tent for my dwelling. In all places where I have moved with all the people of Israel, did I speak a word with any of the judges of Israel, whom I commanded to shepherd my people, saying, why have you not built me a house of cedar? See, what God is doing here is he's pointing David to the history books, saying, look at the history of my people. There's always been an opportunity for a house, and I've never asked for one. And let me tell you, it's not because God is being humble. It's not because he's saying, no, I actually like to look at the stars in my tent at night. That's not why he's turning down the room upgrade. That's not why he refuses to go into first class. No, he's refusing the upgrade because he's saying it's not actually an upgrade for him or for his people. See, what David does here is the problem that every plan throughout history has had. He assumed it was going to work. See, that if he builds a permanent house for God's permanent blessing, then his people will be permanently secure. The problem is that God has never needed a permanent dwelling to be permanently with his people. That's what God is saying. He said, I've always moved with them. Look at verse 7. I have moved with all the people of Israel. God's blessing wasn't a thing that David had to catch out of the sky and grab and hold and keep and maintain. No, as we've been looking at, God's blessing is bound to God's people through promises. Do you remember last week? What did God promise to Moses? That he would make him a nation of priests and a holy kingdom. What did God promise to Abraham? That his descendants would be as numerous as the stars. What did God promise the serpent in front of Adam and Eve? I will crush your head. Those promises have been binding God to his people, and God's done it from his own free will. So why? Why did God reject David's plan? It's because God's people already had God's permanent blessing. They already had what David was thinking he's going to get from this plan. And the further problem with it, not only was he trying to plan for something that God had already given him, he's trying to plan for something that only God can give him. I don't want to labor this point because I think it's kind of made itself, but I think we all know that we can't really plan for permanent security. And I say I don't want to labor this point because I think maybe if I preached this sermon 5 or 7 years ago, I would have needed to explain what I mean. But after a few elections and a pandemic, I think we get it. I think we get it. Whatever your plans are to be permanently secure, I mean, come on. Ask anyone who's gotten sick. Ask anyone who's lost a loved one. Anyone who's undergone a tragedy. Ask them if you can how to plan for permanent security. To be safe forever. We can't get it. The reason I don't want to labor this point, and there's so much to say on this, is because God doesn't really labor this point either. He moves on. He finishes telling David what he has done so he could tell David what he will do. And it brings us to the promise. So we've seen the plan, we've seen the problem, and now the promise. See, look with me in verse 8. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I took you from the pasture, from following the sheep, that you should be prince over my people Israel. And I have been with you wherever you went and have cut off all your enemies before you. In other words, David, the reason you're not building me a house is because I'm the one who does things for you. Look back at David's story. I mean, how did it start? He was a shepherd boy in a field, and it was God's call that brought him out of the field. And how did David ascend to the throne? Well, it wasn't because of David's genius. It was because of God's blessing. And how did David push back all of his enemies? A responsibility of the king, by the way. Look at the beginning of our passage. It says God had given David rest from all his enemies. What God is pointing David to is saying, David, if you look back at your life, you'll see it has not been you. It's been me. So why would it all of a sudden now be you? Why would we now switch roles where you're going to be the one blessing me? No. He says, I'm going to bless you. Look down to verse 9 with me. God says to David, I will make for you a great name, like the name of the great ones on earth. I will appoint a place for my people Israel and will plant them, so that they may dwell in their own place and be disturbed no more, and violent men shall afflict them no more as formerly. From the time that I appointed judges over all my people Israel, and I will give you rest from your enemies. Moreover, the Lord declares to you that the Lord will make you a house. Look at that list of things God says he'll do. Did you notice those are all things that a king is supposed to do? To make his name great? To make his people safe? To defeat his enemies? To set up a dynasty? That's how the word house is being used, by the way. And God says here, I'm going to do all of that. I'm going to do all of this. It's a beautiful thing because David has taken this to mean, now I'm building God a house. God has turned it around and said, David, I will build you a house. Not a house like a building, a house like a dynasty, a lineage. And that's the beautiful thing here. Is God has said, David, as much as you are in this role of king, I'm the one who's upholding you. I'm the one who's fulfilling all the kingly responsibilities. And then he moves to the most important one of all. God has provided security for Israel, and now he moves to talk about permanent security. The kind that eludes so many of us. Look here in verse 12. It says, when your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, that is, David, after you are dead, I will raise up your offspring after you, who shall come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son. When he commits iniquity, that means sin, I will discipline him with the rod of men and with the stripes of the sons of men. But my steadfast love will not depart from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I put away from before you. Now we're going to look at how this passage points to Christ in a minute, but this passage most immediately points to a man named Solomon. Points to David's son, who will build a temple for the Lord, who will sin. And what God says here is that when he sins, I won't remove my love from him. I'll discipline him like a father would a son. See, he sets up a relationship where this person can grow in the relationship, that his sin won't disqualify him. And as we continue through Israel's history, we see how necessary that is. I mean, go and look at Solomon's life. Look at what he does. And look what happens after him. If you've ever read, or you may ever read through 1 and 2 Kings, you'll see so much repetition of exactly this problem. It goes like this a lot. And then so-and-so rose to the throne, and so did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. 400 years of that, and there's no son of David on the throne. all this promise about securing people. I can only imagine that at some point they said, is God ever going to fulfill this promise? Are things ever going to be good? Will we ever be brought to that place of peace? See, they were in exile. There was no king on the throne. And I'm sure they were doubting. Now, we're not exactly in exile. I guess someone could argue that we are in some way, but I think we feel a lot of that same thing. I think we feel a lot of the anxiety around planning and worry. I think it's why a lot of us plan so much. It's because we still think that if we get the right person in the right place at the right time on the right throne and they do the right things, then everything will be all right. Which is why so many people frantically plan to get the security. Let me give you an example. People frantically plan to find the right person to marry so that they'll be secure against ever being lonely or unhappy or sexually unsatisfied ever again. We think that if we get the right employer, then we'll never be unsuccessful. We'll be secure against poverty and insignificance and failure. So many of us think that if we get the right president of the United States, we'll be secure against everything we see on the news that makes us afraid. I mean, more common than anything, we think that maybe will give us our security. That maybe if I get the right routine, the right workouts, the right diet, I'll be secure against any physical ailment. Maybe even death. That maybe if I get famous, I'll be secure against ever being irrelevant ever again. Or if I just work hard enough, I'll be secure against ever feeling lazy. And this is how we end up like all these people, hoping on some person to take the throne and bring us security as we're disappointed when all these things don't work. So let me ask again, what's your plan? More importantly, who does your plan depend on? What's your plan for security? And who does that plan depend on? Who has to do things right for you to get security? But you know, a person giving us security, just another king, that's not really what God promised, did he? You see, if you look back at this promise, yeah, he said he'd establish David's throne forever. That means a king will sit on the throne who's a son of David, so a human. But what else did God say? God said, I will fulfill all the obligations of king. Yes, I'll put a human on the throne, but I will push your enemies away. I will bring my people to a place of security. Therefore, it follows that the only way for this covenant to be fulfilled is if God himself becomes a man and sits on the throne. The only way for our plans, for any plan to ever bring us security, is if God himself comes to sit on this throne he's talking about. And that brings us to the fourth thing, the person. See, as it's Advent, we can see how Jesus' coming was announced like this. When the angel Gabriel came to Mary, this is what he said. Do not be afraid, Mary, for you have found favor with God, and behold, you will conceive in your womb and bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus. He will be great and will be called the Son of the Most High, and the Lord God will give him the throne of his father David. And he will reign over the house of Jacob forever, and of his kingdom there will be no end. So there it is. Waiting all this time for the king to rise. And it's one thing, though, to know this as a piece of Bible trivia. To read 2 Samuel 7 and go, well, I know what Gabriel said. But it's another thing entirely to know how Jesus fulfills this role as king. You see, according to the Bible, some obligations a king has to fulfill. The first among them is he has to defeat Israel's enemies. He has to stand in their place. A story you might know is David and Goliath. It's a great representation of this story. You see, what happens in David and Goliath, the beginning of David's life, is that David is a shepherd boy, and he goes to the front lines of this battle where a Philistine named Goliath steps up and challenges Israel, says, "Send forth your best champion." And so they have to send one man to fight Goliath, and that's how the battle will be decided. And everybody is standing by, petrified of Goliath. And David steps out and represents Israel in this battle, and he wins. And it's a beautiful thing because we could in some way trace this back all the way to our first covenant, Genesis 3:15. You remember this covenant? God says, "I will put enmity between you and the woman," he's talking to the serpent, "between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, you shall bruise his heel." And David and Goliath is a beautiful version of this story. It really represents it well. Could even be fulfilling this covenant, but only gets so close. See, David's a son. Yeah, he's a son. And he goes out, and how does he kill Goliath? Well, yeah, he crushes his head. That's exactly what happens. Yeah, I know it's violent. That's the Bible. And even more, when you look at the Hebrew, and I'm not a Hebrew scholar, I got this from someone else. When you look at how they describe Goliath, it says his armor was scales. Scales as of a snake. And so you have this beautiful picture of the son of woman stepping out to represent God's people, defeating the serpent by crushing the head. But there's only one problem with this story. His heel wasn't bruised. He wasn't wounded. And you see, there's a much greater enemy than Goliath out there. See, there's an enemy that's like Goliath, but worse. And it's sin. And I was thinking of a lot of ways I could try to explain sin, and it's tough because in the story of David and Goliath, you have a very real material enemy stepping out to do battle, and what somebody needs to do is step out and fight it, but sin is more complex than that. Sin not only opposes God's people, not only is it the source of death and sickness, but sin makes defectors out of God's people. This is what we see in the story of Adam and Eve. Not only did the serpent oppose Eve, but the serpent convinced Eve to oppose God. See, not only is sin the author of death and hell and sickness, but sin is the author of every broken marriage, every lie, every case of adultery, every murder, every theft. And sin makes defectors out of all of us. So that if we were to be in the story of David and Goliath, we wouldn't even be the soldiers who were scared, wondering who's going to fight Goliath. We're going to be the Philistines rooting for Goliath. And so how do you defeat an enemy like that? Well, you can't just defeat the enemy. You have to take his power away. You have to make those who he has won to his side renounce him and come back to you. In other words, for Christ to defeat Satan, it wouldn't just mean ending death. It would mean bringing people back into a relationship and love of God. And the only way to do that is to remove their guilt and shame and make them innocent again. And the way to do that is to put their punishment somewhere else. Remember the prophecy? "You shall bruise his heel. The serpent shall wound the son." When I was in high school, I used to wrestle. And I remember this distinctly. I would never get done with my match and see my mom in the stands. And it wasn't because she wasn't there. She was always there. But she didn't like to watch it because she didn't want to see me fight someone and get hurt. She couldn't watch it. It would hurt her too much to watch me. And I remember I had my last tournament of the last year I did wrestling, and I won the gold medal, and I remember having to find my mom to tell her I won because she couldn't watch me get hurt. She couldn't watch me be in a fight. And I'm not a parent, but I have to, I mean, I'm sure other parents understand this. There's got to be nothing worse in the world than watching your kid be hurt. Ever. And there would be no victory that we could ever conceive of as human beings that would be worth watching your child get hurt. And so we can only try to fathom how much God must love each one of us that he would send his son to be wounded at the cross to attain victory over Satan. That would be such a thing he would undertake. And if we know he had that kind of love for us at the cross, then we know that he had it in his promise to David, because that is what it took to bring security as king for God's people. When he promises that he will drive your enemies away and give his people rest, he was promising that he would be wounded to defeat the enemy. And that is Christ on the cross, taking your punishment and my punishment, taking away our enmity with God and putting it on himself. But he was only wounded. Death couldn't hold him. Satan's head was crushed and he was defeated. But Christ rose 3 days later. And he went to his father with that proverbial gold medal. And he knew his father had watched the whole thing. It's a beauty in this, that God would want to deliver you so securely and so safely that he would send his son to be wounded for your sake. That is Christ the King. That is Christ our Savior, our Rescuer, and he's not done. Because see, there is one part of that covenant where it says that the king will, or God will, defeat Israel's enemies, but another when he says he will plant his people in a secure place. So we've looked at the plan, we've looked at the problem with David's plan, we've looked at the promise, we looked at the person, and now I want to show you the place. You see, before Christ went to the cross, this is what he said to his disciples. He says, "Let not your hearts be troubled. Believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and will take you to myself, that where I am, you may be also." It's one thing for a king to defeat the enemy, but the king also needs to deliver his people to a place where they can rest. And what Christ promises here is that the Father has a house for us. Why do you think there are so many rooms? It's because it's for you. It's not happenstance. The house is for you. And Christ says, "I will take you there. I will take you to that place where there will be no more oppressors. There will be no more worry, nor fear, nor anxiety, nor pain, nor sickness." Christ says, "I will come and take you there." And I think the problem that many of us wrestle with in the Christian life is we often define Christianity as walking with God or following Jesus, when those are great sayings, but I think if we understand Christ as King, I think we best define Christianity as being carried by Jesus. I don't think it's about our walk and our following. I think it's about Christ carrying. Because see, as any parent of a toddler will tell you, the toddler doesn't know where to go. They don't know everything. They need to be carried. They need to be held. And that's the wondrous news of the Christian gospel, is all the plans that we've thought of to attain our own permanent security are made unnecessary. Because just as God told David that he will give him this permanent security, he's told that to us. Christ said, "I will take you to that place. I will bring you security." So how we grow in the Christian life is by learning how to be carried better and better. So what does it mean to be carried? Any parent of young children will tell you that squirming does not help. And we are good squirmers. We squirm when we see something we want that's out of our reach when we're being held by God. something that's shiny and attractive. We squirm when we have a plan of where we would like to go. We squirm when we just don't trust that God is taking us somewhere we want to go. Stop squirming. When Jesus was on earth, he said, "Unless you come to me as a child, you cannot receive me." Did you notice he put a child in his lap when he did this? He held them. He's saying that's how we come to him. So what does it mean to be carried by Jesus? It means to set aside your plans for permanent security. And again, plans aren't bad. You've got a plan, but you need to understand that plan will never secure you. Not permanently, but God has promised that he will. So what's your plan? I want to encourage you today to make it a plan to be carried. To write such a plan in a way that's not focused on what you will do, how you will perform, but a plan that focuses on what God will do and what God has done. We don't have a plan for next year's each and every. There's not a fixed result we're going to get out of it. It's a plan that wholly depends on what God will do in our church, how God will move in you. It's how we have to plan every day of ministry and every day of life with Christ, trusting that the Lord will carry us. And I'll end with an illustration. And I'm sure you've heard it, and I'm sure you've heard it in sermons before. And I'll be very cliche in using it, but they made a movie about a man named Desmond Doss. Some people have rolled their eyes because they've heard 100 sermons with this illustration. But if you haven't heard it, I'm saying this for your benefit. There's a World War II soldier named Desmond Doss, and he was a pacifist. As a Christian, he refused to carry a weapon. And so he wanted to serve in World War II on the Pacific Front, but he wanted to serve as a medic. And so he didn't carry a weapon. He went into battle, and everybody made fun of him. And on a ridge called Hacksaw Ridge, the Americans were pushed back off of the ridge, and they had to leave hundreds of troops behind as the Japanese advanced, but Desmond remained overnight. And he had no weapon, charged out into the field, and picked up soldiers. And every time he lowered them down the ridge, he would say, "God, help me get one more." He carried each one of those men. All men who had trained to fight had to be carried by someone who had not trained to fight. That night he carried down 79 men. The job of those men in that moment? Stop squirming. Be carried. And it's that place where anxiety and fear begins to die. And I know that's so easy for me to say. I recently heard somebody say that we don't tend to think our way into new ways of living. We tend to live our way into new ways of thinking. So the only thing I can tell you now is that you are invited to live this way, to live as though you are being carried by God through everything, to see that Christ is your King and he will bring you home. So I want to extend that invitation with words of Christ from the Gospel of Matthew, where he says, "Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen.